UEG Talks, gastroenterology to go. Welcome to our GI podcast. Listen for fresh insights and perspectives in science, education, and professional development.
Welcome to this episode of the UEG Talks. My name is Pradeep Mundre, and I'm your host for today. Now, weight loss drugs and news on the weight loss drugs have become a bit of a trend these days, with significant attention given to these in news channels and social media. We hear about the success story of one drug company, Novo Nordisk, all the time these days in media. And this single company's value is now probably bigger than the entire Danish economy. And this is predominantly driven by its anti-obesity drug. Anti-obesity drug and its market is predicted to reach about $100 billion in the next 6 years or so. And I'm trying to imagine how much this is. I'm not very good with money, but let's put it this way, it's a lot. From a gastroenterologist's perspective, at least from the European gastroenterologist's perspective, we are mainly involved in obesity in probably two main areas. I think first and foremost is the NAFLD or MASLD, and we're pretty clueless about managing these. We just, you know, see the patients, tell them to go away, lose weight and come back, and that's our management. And the other important area where we are involved is from the intervention point of view, i.e. a metabolic endoscopy, endoscopic sleeve gastrectomy, endoscopic balloons. And I guess such procedures are not done in isolation, and they're done in the context of a team, a bariatric team, and in the context of other treatment for obesity. And I feel knowledge on these drugs, anti-obesity surgery, and how metabolic endoscopy fits into all this is very important for us to know. And I'll be discussing these topics in two-part series of this podcast. And in this first episode, we are mainly focusing on anti-obesity drugs. Today's guest is Professor Carole Leroux, Director of Metabolic Medicine at University College Dublin. Professor Leroux graduated from University of Pretoria in South Africa and completed his PhD and registrar training at Imperial College in London, and is currently a professor in Dublin, where his work focuses on how the gut talks to the brain. He's won several awards and supervised MDs and PhDs and has established a very successful research group contributing significantly to this field. Welcome to UEG Talks, Carole.
Thank you so much.
Carole, let's start off by discussing about your own journey in this field. You know, what led you to specialize in this field?
So in 2000, when I sort of started my registrar jobs, you know, I thought that obesity was an intractable problem. I thought it was like a balloon. If you squeeze it on one side, it'll just pop out on the other side. But then I discovered the concept of bariatric surgery, and suddenly there was a treatment that could treat people with obesity and keep them in remission, you know, for 20 years. So I wanted to understand how that worked. I'm an internal medicine doctor. And of course, at the time I was working in Steve Bloom's lab, and we were just discovering the effect of gut hormones and how they change hunger. And that was a revolution. And I was just really lucky to be one of the first people to measure gut hormones after bariatric surgery and show that this was a very important mechanism, hence this idea about how the gut talks to the brain. And it really grew from there. Well, 20 years later, we discovered that, you know, these same gut hormones can be used for the treatment of the disease of obesity, and they work in exactly the same way as bariatric surgery. They're not quite as effective, but neither do they have to be. They are incredibly effective at controlling the disease and keeping the disease in remission.
Excellent. Okay. Things have changed so much in this field, and thanks to science and thanks to people like you. Probably the first topic of discussion could be about the historic perspective of obesity. My understanding, you know, when I go to historic sites and see sculptures, my feeling is that obesity is a modern day disease. And when you look at these ancient sculptures, They look perfectly curated bodies with no hint of obesity. Even in social media these days, all the bodies look perfectly curated, slim. So that's not the reality, right? Maybe the reality was skewed in the past as well. But what does the science tell us? Did obesity exist in the past, or when did it start?
So there's no doubt that obesity has always existed, but the prevalence of obesity really started increasing in the 80s, and it happened all over the world. You know, whether or not you were in a very wealthy country or a very poor country, that infliction point happened somewhere in the 80s, and we don't understand why. Now, the historic perspective has very much been that overeating caused obesity. And that is what drove our thinking, because what we then did is, in your historic perspective, if you think overeating causes obesity, then all your focus will be on trying to make people eat less. But this would be a little bit similar to you thinking that eating sugar causes diabetes. And what you and I know is diabetes is a disease of the pancreas, of the liver, of the muscle, insulin resistance. And clearly, it turns out that the disease of diabetes causes high sugar in the blood. And in the same way, we are now thinking about the disease of obesity. So in the past, the historic perspective was overeating caused obesity. And what modern science teaches us is the opposite is true. The disease of obesity causes overeating. Now, if you live in an environment where food is plentiful, that you can eat as much as you want, that you can eat high-dense, calorie-dense foods, then it turns out, you know, many people with obesity are going to eat calorie-dense foods and too much of it. But, you know, our perspective is changing, and that is part of the reason why we are so successful at treating the disease now, because we are understanding it.
Okay, that's really well said, Carol, that obesity is not a lifestyle problem, but it's a disease.
Correct. It's the disease that causes the lifestyle problem. It's not the lifestyle problem that causes the disease. And hence, you know, we are now able to address it, you know, in an appropriate way. We just treat obesity now as a chronic disease in exactly the same way as I would treat hypertension or dyslipidemia or asthma. I'm just treating it as a chronic disease.
Now, We talked about how obesity existed in the past, and you mentioned that the prevalence is kind of going up. What's the scale of the problem, you know, either financially or monetarily currently, and how do you see things changing in the future?
So most people in the developed world, you know, about 25% to 30% of people in the developed world at the moment have the disease of obesity. And it's not the disease of obesity that causes the financial challenges. It's the complications of this disease. It's the complications, for example, such as MASH or such as diabetes or such as cardiovascular disease. So what we are now thinking is, can we treat the disease of obesity to disrupt the complications? Can we even reverse the complications? And what we are now seeing is, with surgical treatments and also with our medical treatments now, we can, for example, put type 2 diabetes in remission. We can turn the clock back. And that's incredible. You know, so you think if somebody's diagnosed with type 2 diabetes today, you change their life expectancy, you change their mortgage, you change, you know, their life insurance, you change the way they think about themselves. And what you can now do is you can say, that's a really bad disease, but we can now put it in remission. We can make you normoglycemic again. We can take away the insulin resistance. We can take away the problems of insufficient insulin secretion, because we are disrupting it by treating the disease of obesity. And I think what we need to consider, you know, many people listening to us today, they would think, you know, what do I want to do? Do I want to run a slimming club? Do I want to make people lose weight? Or do I want to treat the chronic disease and make patients healthier? So we are constantly now talking about, these are not weight loss drugs, but they are health gain drugs. Or this is not weight loss surgery, this is health gain surgery, or endoscopy, same thing. So it's important that we frame it so that you and I as a medical practitioner can actually have access to this in a philosophical way. You know, as I said, I don't run slimming clubs. You know, I don't care what people weigh, but I really care about their health, and that's what I can improve.
That's a very good perspective, Carl. I think, you know, most of us, even medical professionals, probably think of treatment of obesity as just with an aim to reduce weight with whatever intention that would be. But your perspective that treatment of obesity is not just about losing weight, it's about changing the outcomes is really well put. And I think it's very important for all of us, including medical professionals, to understand that in much more detail. Thank you for that. Now, on that note, can I ask you, in terms of treatment for obesity, so what are your aims other than, you know, losing weight? What is your aim? Let's say you want to develop a new drug.
Yeah. So my aim at the moment is to put the disease of obesity in remission and keep the disease in remission in the long term. Now, if you ask most of the people listening to this, you know, if this is a disease, if you buy into this concept that it's a disease, which organ is responsible for the disease of obesity? And now we're going to have a lot of different opinions. And most people would actually be focusing on the adipocyte and say, you know, the adipocyte is a very active organ. Maybe that is the disease of obesity's origins. In fact, we now understand the adipocyte is a consequence of the disease of obesity. And it turns out maybe about 80%, and we also even, let me say this, we don't actually even think that obesity is one disease. You know, we think it's multiple diseases that leads to excess adipose tissue. But about 80% of these diseases appear to be situated in the subcortical areas of the brain. This is things like the hypothalamus, the area postrema, the nucleus tractus solitarius. So I now think of obesity as a neurological disease. It's not in the cortical areas of the brain. So when I treat my patients, I don't make them more intelligent or more motivated. All I do is I make them less hungry and I make them more satisfied. And that's situated in the subcortex. Now, the reason why I'm saying that is that my objective now is to actually control this disease in the subcortical areas of the brain. So therefore, whatever I'm going to do, if I'm going to use a nutritional therapy, a pharmacotherapy, an endoscopy therapy, a surgical therapy, it's all about treating the subcortex of the brain. And hence coming back to this idea how the gut talks to the brain. And therefore, whatever I do must be sustainable, because it's only when it's sustainable that I will actually get the long-term benefits. And those would be the reduction in complications that already exist or the prevention of the complications that may come in the future.
And these would be mainly multi-system rather than cardiovascular or the measurable ones, right?
Yeah, we think about it. We say, you know, if you know obesity, you know medicine, because there's more than 220 complications of the disease of obesity. But we group them, you know, in metabolic, mechanical, or mental. And so it may be that some people have zero metabolic complications. You know, they have a BMI of 35 or 40, but they have perfectly intact glycemic control, no dyslipidemia, no hypertension, you know, but they may have significant mechanical problems. They may have osteoarthritis, for example. Another person would have no weight-bearing problems, but may suffer because of the stigma of obesity and may develop, you know, a very poor quality of life, you know, because of that. So, you know, it's the patient in front of you and you have to work out what is, and that comes down to a little bit of personalized medicine. You know, what does the person in front of you suffer from or at risk of? And that is going to be my complication. I would imagine if a patient comes to you, you would be far more focused, for example, on the liver or, for example, on reflux disease. Those are very, you know, common complications, you know, of the disease of obesity. And, you know, we can significantly improve both of those.
So there's no one single outcome, and I guess depending on the perspective, you can choose, I guess, different outcomes.
That's true, but I would also say what we have learned is that we need to get at least double-digit weight loss. So we need to get at least 10% weight loss to make a difference when it comes to the complications. And 15% weight loss appears to be the sweet spot where we get a substantial improvement across the board. So this is not to diminish the fact that, you know, our efficacy outcome, how do I know if my treatments work, is ultimately, you know, what percentage weight loss I get. But in the same way as when I treat somebody with diabetes, I'm not a sugarologist. You know, I don't care what the sugar is, but I use the hemoglobin A1C or the fasting glucose to tell me how effective my treatments are, because I want to prevent the microvascular or macrovascular complications of diabetes.
Is that two-digit weight loss? That's a surrogate for good health outcomes for our patients, in simple terms.
Correct. So if I don't get, you know, double-digit weight loss, if I don't get 10% weight loss, then my treatment isn't good enough and I stop it and I change. So say, for example, I start somebody on a nutritional therapy for obesity, but I don't get double-digit weight loss, then, you know, I don't blame my patient, or I don't think I'm a bad doctor or a bad nutritional therapy. I just say, you know, this treatment is not the right treatment for this disease. And what I'm now going to do is I'm going to change tack. I'm going to change to an endoscopic therapy or a pharmacotherapy or surgical therapy.
So moving on, can you give us a historic perspective of medical therapy in obesity? You know, when did it all start? I've heard of various horror stories in the treatment in the past, but maybe you can tell us in brief how it all started.
Sure. You know, and I think it comes back to this idea that what people thought we needed to do is to reduce, you know, intake. And therefore, what people did is, like, you know, they did jaw wiring, you know, they just wired people's jaws shut. But that wasn't effective because they became hungry. And then they tried, you know, just starving people, locking people up, you know, for 2 weeks, you know, and, you know, giving them milk to drink. And then when they came out, they were just like starving Marvin. They were just incredibly hungry. And then, you know, they gave them amphetamines. And amphetamines were very good if you wanted to vacuum clean your carpets, you know, and vacuum clean your curtains even. But it, you know, again, the minute it stopped, people became hungry. And I think what you are seeing is now we talk about this two concepts. One concept is a weight loss treatment, and a completely separate concept is a treatment for the disease of obesity. Now, you know, you have a weight loss treatment if somebody becomes hungry. Okay. And, you know, I would argue again, and this is controversial, but let's get into it. I would say that a gastric balloon is a weight loss treatment. Okay. Because what you are doing is you're restricting food intake, but it does not allow people to feel less hungry for the rest of their lives, right? But for example, an endoscopic sleeve could be an obesity treatment, because what you are doing is you are fundamentally changing how the gut talks to the brain, and it could be a sustainable treatment in the long term. You know, the historic perspective was about weight loss. That's bad. The current perspective is about treating the disease of obesity in the long term, and that is good.
Carl, before we understand the new drugs, which we will go to in a moment, maybe it's important for me or the audience to understand in very simple terms the simple physiology of weight management, you know, how the brain and the gut and the adipose tissue, how they interact. Can you kind of keep it brief and explain this in simple terms so that we can understand the drugs, how they work?
Sure. All right. So let me try and explain to it with an example that you guys will be familiar with. So we think that all organs in the body has a certain weight that is physiologically determined. And you would know if you, for example, have a patient donate the left lobe of their liver for somebody to have a transplant, what will happen is that liver will grow back to exactly the same weight it had prior to you taking the left lobe. Now, it'll look a bit knobbly and look a little bit odd, but nonetheless, the weight will be exactly the same. The same is true if you live at sea level and you go and live, you know, for 3 months or 6 months at 4,000 meters above sea level, what will happen is your red blood cell mass will increase. Okay. But the minute you come back to sea level, your red blood cell mass will come to exactly the same level that it was, you know, before you left. Okay. So you've got physiological control of organs, weight. And we now think that adipocyte weight, the organ of adipocytes, are regulated in the same way. So you may have person A that will have a certain adipocyte mass. And that adipocyte mass seems to be regulated by the subcortex of the brain. So if you now change the adipocyte mass, so for example, I do liposuction, I just remove the adipocytes, right? What will happen is those adipocytes will grow back to exactly the same mass, you know, that they were before. Or if I make you starve, you know, I just put you in a starvation diet, I reduce your adipocyte mass. The minute I stop the starvation diet, your adipocyte mass will come back to exactly the same weight. Okay. But now with the new treatments, what we are doing is we are fundamentally changing the regulation of the adipocyte mass. So the minute I start my treatment, the body comes under the impression that it's carrying 10 or 15 or 20% too many adipocytes. And what the body will do is just naturally come down to the new physiological point. You know, it's a homeostasis point. Now, of course, the only way, say, for example, you weigh 100 kilograms and your body wants you to weigh 80 kilograms, what will happen is you'll feel less hungry, you'll feel more full. But the minute you get to 80 kilograms, you will just feel normal. You will be in homeostasis. And that is currently what we are struggling to communicate to our patients, because the minute they, when they're losing weight and they feel less hungry, feel more full, they feel like $1 million, they think this is normal. But when they get to the new homeostatic point, they suddenly feel normal and it scares them. And that's where we have to be better at communicating, better at understanding the disease. So that's sort of a brief, you know, 101 of obesity, you know, thinking at the moment.
Yeah, that's well put, Carmel. Let's move on to the anti-obesity sort of medications. Maybe we don't have to discuss everything, all of those classes. So maybe you can explain the most relevant ones in this day and age. You know, how do they work? How effective are they in the current scenario?
So you, as a gastroenterologist, I think you're sitting on a gold field, because, you know, every time you and I have a meal, we release this perfect concert of gut hormones. And these hormones are predominantly driven by the endocrine cells, you know, in the proximal as well as in the distal small intestine. And these hormones, you know, bind multiple receptors. So they bind receptors in the liver, they bind receptors in the pancreas, they bind receptors, you know, in the subcortex of the brain. And for the purposes of obesity, we are really interested in how these gut hormones bind these receptors in the subcortical areas of the brain. Now, if you think about the endocrine cells, you know, they will release hormones such as GLP-1, they will release GIP, they will release glucagon, you know, they will release PYY, they will release oxyntomodulin. Now, all those hormones I just mentioned, all of those hormones are now being turned into pharmacological treatments. And the way we started was with one of those hormones, GLP-1, and that hormone became medication that we now know as liraglutide or semaglutide or exenatide. That was all based on around the GLP-1 hormone.
So what's GLP, just for the audience?
Sure, that's glucagon-like peptide 1. So glucagon-like peptide 1, GLP-1, PYY is peptide YY, and GIP is gastroinhibitory peptide. That was the very old name. So now what we have is this idea that, can we mimic natural physiology? And that's what we learned from bariatric surgery, because, and also when endoscopy is a true treatment for the disease of obesity, is what you then do is you amplify all of those endogenous hormones. So you increase it three or fourfold. and hence why people, you know, can't be treated for the disease of obesity. But now, what about this idea if I just give you these hormones exogenously? So if, you know, this is a natural hormone, so of course, if you swallow it, your stomach acids will denature it. So we give it as an injection either once a day, but now mostly once a week, mostly not once a month, you know, that's in the pipeline. So, and now all the companies are doing is they're just combining the hormones. So we have, for example, semaglutide that you spoke about made by Novo Nordisk that's really started this field and really made an incredible impact, but that's one hormone. But now we have tirzepatide that's made by another company, by Lilly, and they, you know, have combined GLP-1 and GIP. And now we have survodutide, which is yet another hormone made by Boehringer Ingelheim, and they now have combined GLP-1 plus glucagon. And you have retatrutide, where you combine three hormones, you know, so now you have GLP-1, GIP, and glucagon. So what you are seeing is we are mimicking natural physiology. And every time you combine it, you get more efficacy. But what we are now seeing, especially when we have combined the glucagon components, now you see this incredible impact on the liver when it comes to MASH. And so hence the New England Journal papers showing that we can actually reverse fibrosis. So it's not only the weight loss, it's also these hormones have independent benefits because there's independent receptors. And if you, for example, bind a glucagon receptor, you have much more efficacy when it comes to MASH and reversing fibrosis. But so that's the revolution that's happening at the moment.
And in terms of absolute numbers for efficacy, where are we at this stage? You know, if you just give a context of comparing this, as I always take surgery as a gold standard, if you just try and sort of compare it with that, and where are we at with regards to drugs, a new class of drugs?
So surgery will give between 25 and 30% weight loss after 1 year. So if we think about a gastric bypass, you know, operation, the current medications such as semaglutide will give 16% weight loss. But the medication that's already licensed and available in the UK, that's now the next level up, is tirzepatide. That gives 22% weight loss.
And is that in Europe as well? Is that licensed in Europe?
Yeah, so that's available in Europe, in the US, and the UK as well. And now, when we look at the phase 3 studies currently ongoing, you will see that now we're going to look at 25% weight loss on average. Now, remember, that's 25% weight loss on average, but that means that approximately a third of people will lose more than 30% of their weight. Okay. So with surgery, you will get half of people losing, you know, 30% of their weight. With medications, you're going to get a third of people losing 30% of their weight. But, you know, it's a Gaussian distribution. So there will also be 10 to 20% of people who lose less than 10% of their weight. So this means that these medications are not going to treat everybody. They're going to treat a large number of people incredibly effectively, but there's always going to be a percentage of patients that may need a different treatment. And hence why, you know, when you started, you know, we had this, you made a comment with maybe some of the endoscopy treatments or surgical treatments will come to their natural end. But I actually think the opposite is going to happen. I think what these drugs are going to do, they're going to be like gateway drugs. Because imagine you start somebody on a medication and, you know, their neighbor went on to lose 30% of their weight, but they only lose 5% of their weight. They're going to say, you know what, this was obviously, I tried, I was compliant, this didn't work for me. What can I do next? Right. And what we're going to see is now patients need to be referred, for example, for endoscopic treatments or for surgical treatments. And I think that's why you're going to see an increase in the absolute number of patients being referred and needing, you know, either endoscopic or surgical interventions.
Okay. Carol, just thinking about it, you mentioned double-digit weight loss as a magic number to improve the outcomes. Is there, let's say, if we move on from 10% to 30%, is that incremental weight loss translate to incremental health benefits for our patients? And is there a ceiling?
So it depends a little bit on what complication you're dealing with. So for example, if you deal with a metabolic complication, there are additional benefits, but it's not linear. Right. So you get most of your benefits, you know, up to 15% weight loss. But if you get 20%, 25% weight loss, you do get additional benefits, but it's not linear. All right. So see, for example, medications that give 15% weight loss and medications that give 25% weight loss have the same impact on hemoglobin A1C on average. But if you think about functional benefits, so now you have somebody with a body mass index of 45, right? You make them lose 10% of their weight. Functionally, they move a lot better. But you make them lose 20% of their weight. Now you're on a linear curve, effectively, because functionality will improve in a linear way, etc. Now, what we don't know is, for example, the liver. You know, where do we sit? Does it look more like functional gains? Does it look more like metabolic gains? And especially now that we have treatments that have weight loss independent benefits on the liver, and those are the glucagon, you know, components, you know, you're going to see benefits that's beyond weight loss as well. So that complicates the matter a little bit, but it again allows you to really deliver personalized medicine.
Carol, I want to move on to the relative positioning of different treatment modalities. It may not be easy, but maybe you can make it simple. So where do the drugs fit compared to sort of bariatric endoscopy, compared to surgery? Or is there a linear way? And my simple mind says, yeah, lifestyle first, medications next, endoscopy next, and then surgery. But it may not be that simple. So if you just kind of make it slightly clear for us, if possible.
I mean, you know, we don't know is the answer. And it's fair to say when we don't know, we need to do more research and we need to understand it. There's a different perspective to take. And the perspective is that we can ask our patients. And when we do that, and we have some research in this field at the moment, so if we take people, and we've done that, we've taken patients with a BMI of 35 with MASH. Right. We've never been formally diagnosed with obesity or treated for obesity. And then we ask these patients and we present in equipoise to them nutritional therapies, pharmacotherapies, and surgical therapies. And we say to the patients, what do you want? And it turns out that about half of people with a BMI of 35 with MASH says, I do not want a surgical treatment. I do not want a medication. The only thing I would be interested in is a nutritional therapy. About 20% of people say, you know, I would like to have a surgical or endoscopic therapy. And about 30% say that I would like to have a medication. So I think if we try that approach, you know, let's ask our patients. People are smart, you know, people know what they want, what they don't want. If we can present all of this information in equipoise to them, then what we can do is we can stream them. And I must say to you, I have seen thousands of people with obesity, and I'm about as good as flipping a coin to predict who is going to do well with nutritional therapy, pharmacotherapy, or surgical therapy. So if I can't predict, and there's zero blood tests or questionnaires that can predict, you know, we can may as well ask our patients, where do they want to start? But what we do now is say somebody says, you know, I would like to start with a nutritional therapy. That's absolutely fine. We start with the nutritional therapy, but we always make it clear that all the other treatments remain on the table. So if it works, and we know it works very well in 2 in 10 people, then job done. But if it doesn't work, we can always escalate. And there's no harm in doing that.
Okay. So it's more of a sort of knowing all the treatment, knowing how they work, and sort of offering that to our patients. And there's no sort of a linear fashion. There's no one after the other type treatment that you need to choose. Okay. You know, as gastroenterologists, at least in the UK, we are not using these drugs ourselves. It's probably primary care or the endocrinologist. But we probably see GI side effects of this. Maybe our audience will like to know what are the side effects, GI side effects to look out for when patients take these medications, the newer ones.
Yeah, and you know, I did a lot of the first-in-to-man studies together with the team in Steve Bloom's lab, and I always said, you know, I could make anybody vomit. You know, I just turn up the dial. So what we are seeing is right next to the subcortical areas of the brain that has, you know, the disease of obesity, you know, sits the vasal dorsal complex, and that drives a lot of the nausea. So a very common side effect would be nausea. And what we have now also learned in clinical practice is that our regulatory trials, when we did those trials, we were too aggressive when the dose titration. And we forced people to titrate doses, and hence we actually caused people to vomit. So now in clinical practice, if I start on a dose, for example, somebody has nausea, I just keep them on that same dose until the nausea goes away before I escalate. So I never escalate the medications if people have nausea. And by slowing the dose titration down, I am alleviating the vast majority of these complications. Now, the nausea and the vomiting are typically complications or side effects that come in the beginning and go. They come and go. Okay. But what we see, constipation is something that comes and stays. Because again, you know, you guys as gastroenterologists will tell me that there's a large number of these GLP-1 receptors on the small intestine and PYY receptors on the small intestine. And its job, its function, that when we studied this in the 1970s and 80s, were actually to reduce gastric transit, but also small bowel transit. Right. And therefore, we see constipation as a very substantial complication. And again, in the same way, what we now do is we manage it very proactively. And if somebody does have constipation, we do not increase the dose. I mean, because if you do that, we are now seeing some people developing functional ileus. And that's something that is just preventable with any sensible medical treatment. You know, we should not increase the dose if people have substantial side effects or complications.
Okay. Another topic of relevance, I think you already alluded to, you mentioned the term MASLD or MASH. MASH is metabolic associated steatohepatitis, just in case. Even I wouldn't have been aware of this. I'm not a hepatologist. So just quick word on where these drugs stand in the treatment of MASLD, in changing the outcomes of this disease, in preventing progression.
So I think when we looked at MASLD, what we are able to see is substantial weight loss, 16%, 20% weight loss, can stop the progression. So what you are doing is you are devoiding the liver of fat, and therefore you are, you know, reducing the inflammation that you would see. But if we now go one step further and we look at MASH with established fibrosis, now the new treatments that's currently in phase 3 development, you know, they have shown in their phase 2 studies, again published in New England Journal, that they can reverse fibrosis. Now that is revolutionary, right? And we know that that's possible with bariatric surgery, and we've known for some time with bariatric surgery that we can reverse fibrosis. But now, if we even like, you know, F2, F3 type of fibrosis, so I think that's going to be the next level up. And that's where you and your colleagues will be using these treatments as standard, because, you know, this is a gut hormone. You guys, you know, are experts in the gut. This is an effect on the liver, you know, which is part of your remit. And therefore, if you are a gastroenterologist that is not focused on the liver, but you do diagnose somebody with MASLD, you would be able to start these medications, because it's incredibly easy to use these medications. And any, you know, general practitioner, any surgical specialist, medical specialist will be able to use these drugs. And I think that it's going to become a little bit like statins or ACE inhibitors. You know, you are not a hypertension expert, but, you know, you would be able to start an ACE inhibitor, or, you know, you will be able to start a statin, and that's going to be at the same level. These drugs are as safe, if not safer, than ACE inhibitors and statins.
So there's finally, we have something to offer to our MASLD patients, which is interesting. Moving on to the final bits of this, how do you see the future of weight loss management, you know, where are we headed? You mentioned about drugs, probably the way things are going or what you mentioned, feel that drugs will eventually replace surgery and endoscopic interventions. But that's not the case, you mentioned, depending on the patients, how they respond. So where do you see the future? Where are we headed?
So at the moment, the calculations would suggest that we are treating fewer than 2% of people who have the disease of obesity. And even that 2% has now completely devoided all the medication stocks. You know, there's not enough medications to actually go around. We talk about these shortages. But of course, this is just a function of, you know, how much can the companies make? And they're building more factories, and we're going to get even easier medications that can be manufactured. So I don't think that's going to be a problem. But I think our challenge is going to be the future. The near future is going to be the people who are coming to us at the moment are what I call the enthusiasts, right? They want to be treated. I don't have to convince them to be treated. They come to me, say, please treat me. Okay. But I'm already indicated there's about 50% of people that do not want to take any medications, even if they have severe complications because of obesity. And that's going to be a conversation that you and I will have to have with our patients and say, you know, you have a disease, for example, MASH, and this disease is caused by another disease, obesity, and this disease, neither of these diseases are your fault, but it is your responsibility and my responsibility to find a treatment. And here are treatments that can now be successful. So what our challenge is going to be, the future for obesity care is going to be, how do we move this away from weight loss to chronic disease management? And that's what I'm pleading for, is do not treat obesity any more special or less special than you would treat any other chronic disease. It is just a chronic disease. Put it in that box and just manage it as you would do with any other chronic disease. But that's going to be our challenge in the next couple of years.
Right. And any final thoughts, any take-home messages for our listeners? I think you mentioned just now, if there's anything else before we conclude.
So we teach our medical students and our general practitioner colleagues just to do three things, you know, when they meet a patient, you know. So first of all, you say to the patient that you have the disease of obesity. This disease is not your fault, but the science has changed completely and we now have treatments. That's the second thing. And then the third thing you say is, would you like me to treat you or would you like me to refer you? So just having that 30-second conversation with your patient allows you to deal with this in a respectful way, in a scientific way, and allows you to actually get to the nub of it, which is, does this patient, would they like treatment, yes or no, and what are your next steps? So those three simple things, do that, and that will simplify how we approach obesity.
Carl, it's been eye-opening for me, even in the preparation for this podcast and in the last 40 minutes or so, what we've covered. I feel enlightened and hope our listeners are as well. Thanks for taking time to come over and dedicate your time for this podcast. I hope you've enjoyed and hope our listeners enjoy too. Thanks very much.
Thank you.